We'd like to welcome everyone for coming to session 352, The Future of Dialogue, What Might the Next 50 Years Bring? I'm not going to read this entire script because I know you've probably all heard it about 10 times now, but I would just remind everyone to make sure your cell phones are turned off. And the title of this is, As Bob Dylan Suggests, The Times Are a-Changin', and so must ways of reaching one's intended audience. Please join recent and current dialogue editors and board members as they discuss how to keep the journal relevant and accessible in this digital century with far more accessibility to studies and reflections on all aspects of Mormon history, culture, art, and thought than ever before. Come with your ideas as well. Our presenters are Boyd J. Peterson, to my right. He is the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and serves as the program coordinator for Mormon Studies at Utah Valley University. He's also the author of Dead Wood and Rushing Water, essays on Mormon faith, culture, and family, as well as Hugh Nibley, A Consecrated Life. We also have Emily Jensen here. Emily writes, edits, and mothers five children, often simultaneously. For 5 years, Emily covered the online world of Mormonism for the Deseret News and currently web edits Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Christine Hagland is not here, but Emily is going to share her thoughts. Christine is a former editor of Dialogue, a current and former essayist at the web blogs By Common Consent and Times and Seasons, and noted Mormon historian and cultural commentator. She has an AB from Harvard in German Studies and an MA from the University of Michigan in German Literature. Thank you all for coming.
Okay. All right. Christine felt so bad about not being here. She loves to be here among friends and to be able to talk about Dialogue, but there's a lot of problems with planes down over in the east, and so her flight was canceled. Anyway, but I'm channeling her by showing you the shoes that she sent along with her paper that said, she said, these are the shoes I would have worn had I come to Dialogue. And so you can all enjoy those shoes. Okay, so pretend I'm Christine. For most of its existence, Dialogue had a functional monopoly on scholarly work on Mormonism. There simply weren't many other venues for publication of non-devotional treatments of Mormon topics. In the last decade, however, an explosion of scholarly interest in Mormon topics, a small explosion, more bottle rocket than nuclear bomb, but still, has meant that Dialogue can no longer look forward to submissions of work from the very best scholars working on Mormonism. There are several reasons for this, mostly entirely outside of Dialogue's control. Number one, publications in Dialogue don't count toward tenure in most institutions. Although Dialogue articles are peer-reviewed, Dialogue's funding model is not typical for scholarly journals, and its inclusion of fiction, essays, poetry, sermons, etc., make tenure committees understandably skeptical. While the tenure track has never been a comfortable place to lie down and take a nap, it has become dramatically more cutthroat in the last two decades. Young professors just can't afford to spend time on anything that won't end up in their tenure dossier. Two, publications in Dialogue may, in fact, count against tenure in some cases. On the one hand, religious belief is not always popular in the academy. Outing oneself as a Mormon seriously interested in Mormonism can be risky. And on the other hand, in the one place where being a Mormon seriously interested in Mormonism is supposed to be a good thing, BYU, publishing in Dialogue has been viewed as unfaithful and is explicitly verboten. Three, Mormon-themed publications have multiplied like, well, Mormons. The Maxwell Institute's Mormon Studies Review is the most important new competitor for Dialogue, but several other journals are publishing things Dialogue would have liked to have. Element, Mormon Historical Studies, Segula, International Journal of Mormon Studies, Square 2. Blogs have also filled many of the functions Dialogue used to serve, offering community for Mormon nerds of all ideological stripes and interest groups. There's excellent historical work at Keep a Pitchin' and Juvenile Instructure, Theological Conversation at Faith-Promoting Rumor, Feminist Foment and Personal Essays at Feminist Mormon Housewives and Exponent, Literature at Motley Vision, and everything including the kitchen sink at By Common Consent. It is now possible to publish work on Mormonism in real academic journals. Sam Brown's article in Church History, Jared Hickman's article on the Book of Mormon in American Literature, Michael McBride's work on the economics of religion, including Mormonism, in the American Journal of Sociology and Rational in Society, Steve Taysom's forthcoming article on exorcism, Lowry Mothley Kipp's articles in Religion and American Culture and other journals, Quincy Newell's article on Jane Manning James in Journal of Africana Religions, and other too numerous to mention. All of this work might have one time pound its weight onto the pages of Dialogue. It would be foolish to be unhappy about the interest of the broader scholarly world in Mormon studies. Ultimately, this is good for Mormon studies and for Mormonism in a myriad of ways, a development much to be celebrated. Still, for thoughtful Mormons who want to know how scholars think about their faith, it is potentially also a loss. I want to talk a little bit about the contours of that loss and, of course, about Faust. There was a time not all that long ago when it was possible to feel that one had a grip on most of what was going on in the Mormon intellectual world. One might have been bored with correlated lesson materials and moved on to Hugh Nibley and BYU studies, keep up with subscriptions to Dialogue and Sunstone, and feel reasonably well informed. Even if the tidy certainties of official Mormondom no longer offered the comfort they once had, there could be a certain satisfaction in the essential knowability of Mormon historical and theological scholarship. Like Faust, one might declare that one had studied through philosophy and theology from end to end. Even if one felt it was impossible to read everything, this was largely a matter of time, no one would have felt it necessary to make a bargain with, thank you, to wrap his or her head around the fundamental of Mormon studies as it existed, say, in 1966. The notion that one could bring his faith into the dialogue with a larger stream of religious thought and with the human experience as a whole, as Dialogue mission statement puts it, seems so adorably overweening now. It is good to be humble about what one can know, of course, but there is also some sadness in the humility. The exile from the correlated world seems harsher when it thrusts one into a wilderness that is too vast to ever traverse or fully map. There's another kind of confidence in that early Mormon world that is even more heartbreaking. Reading through the early issues of Dialogue, one is struck by a lack of any sense of danger. There's excitement, a bit of thrill, but not a fear. If you guys, any of you were at the one yesterday, you kind of got that as the older editors were talking about the excitement they felt and the naivete going forward in their editorships and then kind of being brought down to the real world. Gene England, Francis Menlove, Bob Reese, Wes Johnson, Mary Bradford, Truman Madsen, they all write it with a sense of the difficulty of their project, but also with a confidence in the fundamental Mormonness of their project. While they might question their own faith, there's so little worry about others impugning their faithfulness because they are asking these questions. I want to be careful here, she says. I'm not suggesting that they were all naive, and I do suspect they're maybe a little more performance in their confidence. Hopefully we're lucky enough to have a few of those folks here who can help us read between the lines in the Q&A session. Having lived through the intervening 50 years, of course, we can't muster the same confidence or trust. A tragic enmity between the intelligentsia and the institutional church is, if not unbridgeable, still always an established feature of our cautiousness. Before we even type the word polygamy into a search engine, we know we're doing something that puts us odd with the institutional church. There is no longer such thing as an innocent curiosity. Perhaps the most unfortunate effect of this expansion and fracturing of the Mormon intellectual multiverse is the loss of trusted guides. Maybe the most disheartening thing I've heard in a long time is the expressed mistrust by some members about the Gospel Topics essays on LDS.org or about the site MormonsandGays.com. Some folks have convinced themselves that these resources are just a sop that the brethren had to offer to the, quote, liberals or, quote, intellectuals, that of course they aren't what the official church really wants us to believe, but they're forced to be, quote, politically correct, to cater to the weakness of would-be saints who just can't handle the truth. On the opposite side, of course, are those who won't give any credit to the institution for trying to tell a fuller version of its story, but insist that if it isn't an abject confession of the worst imaginable account of church leaders' actions and motives, it's mere apologetic whitewash. So the official church isn't trusted by anyone in this guide, and there are no alternatives. As editor of Dialogue, I've been accused of being faithless and intellectually dishonest, of remaining active the church for financial, she says, ha, and social benefits. Of not caring about gay Mormons, of being obsessed with gay issues, of not publishing enough women authors, of being obsessed with feminist issues. I know that this is exactly what happens to everyone who tries to say anything publicly about Mormonism. Dozens of people here and around Sunstone can tell these same stories. We have imported the mantra of American politics since the 60s, trust no one, into Mormonism with terribly painful results. It's not only that people are leaving the church, but that they are leaving based on really bad information, bad history, terrible logic, and oversimplified notions about institutional behaviors. Worst of all, they leave with unnecessary bitterness and pain. They feel betrayed and completely alone. And those who stay end up also feeling alone with the added temptation to pride and smugness that comes with the sense that they figured it out on their own, and they alone are able to wade through the morass of information about Mormonism. And she ends with some Faust. What a sudden rapture leaps from this. I view through all my senses swiftly flowing. I feel a youthful, holy, vital bliss in every vein and fiber newly glowing. Am I a god? So clear mine eyes. In these pure features I behold creative nature to my soul unfold. This atomization, the sense that every person is an island and his or her knowledge, she's doing Latin, I can't read it, is something, is the greatest threat to Mormonism. Phil Barlow has been saying interesting things for a while now about how the Joseph Smith Papers Project was aimed at slowing or countering the fracturing of a coherent worldview that he and others at the time sensed in the early 19th century. The idea that Mormonism is a technology for gathering fragments, putting them back together, and reanimating, reenchanting a world rings true to me, feels ever so more necessary in the early 21st century. The truest Mormonism insists not on a coherent system that makes arid and permanent sense of our fragmented and partial knowledge, but on the possibility of finding guides, true messengers who will help us beyond our capacity to make intellectual sense of things. It insists, in fact, that these guides are truth, that we, each of us, are the keys to the saints' knowledge and salvation, that our covenant relationships with each other bind us to God and prepare us to receive godlike wisdom. And Faust, of course, there are guides, but Faust misses them. First Gretchen and then Helen of Troy are sent to teach him about human goodness and the possibility of beauty on earth. He not only fails to learn the lessons they offer, he destroys them by his arrogance and ignorance. He is saved, ambiguously, at the end because he finally realizes that the purity and beauty of the virginal Gretchen and the classically perfect Helen are meant to encourage human striving, but are not really the source of truth. Truth is ordinary people trying and endlessly failing to reach the utopian perfection sketched out by intellectual and artistic endeavor. It is a moment of such ordinary work and partial satisfaction when Faust is finally tempted to commit to, for which he feels he could end his restless striving for power, and capital T, truth. Now, I don't want to compare dialogue to Helen of Troy. Okay, yes, I do. Not just dialogue, but Sunstone Exponent and every other place where Mormons work out their ideas with care, with fear and trembling, have the possibility of being guides through the clutter of quick and easy factoids. And I mean that in the real sense of the word, not just small bits of information, but things that are like facts but aren't, about Mormonism that pass for an intellectual approach to Mormon these days and an antidote to the potentially arid theorizing of Mormonism that is momentarily fashionable in the academy. As the world of scholarship about Mormonism becomes more rarefied and professionalized, Godspeed to it, and dialogue contains less of the primary source material of Mormon studies, it can retain its vital function as a place of, well, dialogue between the academic discipline of Mormon studies and the life of Mormonism in the pews and in the world. Dialogue and Sunstone and other, dare we call them, institutions at this point, are exactly the right place to work out and model the kind of thoughtful Mormon life that can be an antidote to the painful cycling between comfortable, unexamined certainty, crisis of faith, and lonely, smug certainty that is all too common lot these days. I think we have to remain committed to long forms, to the difficult and collaborative work of peer review and editing, to the endless and impossible task of dialogue and moderation, because that is Mormonism. Mormonism is not the hastily solo-written blog post with a stream of snarky drive-by comments based on the title rather than the daunting four paragraphs of the post itself. It is not a Facebook link to some tidbit from an ideological echo chamber. It is not a chatty podcast full of unchecked assumptions and sloppy opinions. Mormonism forces us to live with the regular aches of humility and uncertainty, to face the pain of exposing our most cherished beliefs to loving criticism, and to endure the agony of endless revision. This is the stuff of life and repentance, and it would be unbearable if we had to do it alone, and that is why dialogue must and will endure for another 50 years. The end. Can you guys see that okay? Yeah, maybe go like this. Do it over here. Okay. So now I'm switching. Now I'm me. Now I'm Emily Jensen. And I work on the social media and kind of keep the website humming along. And so what I'm going to do is, Christine kind of talked about a vision of the past, present, and future Mormonism. I'm going to kind of just take you through the present dialogue and what we're kind of doing these days to keep it, like I said, humming along. And since I'm so well-versed with the website, I'm just going to kind of show maybe some of the things that you're missing if you're not going to the website, and why it's important to check in there every now and again. First of all, this is the main page. If you guys haven't visited lately, you should. Maybe about weekly. We try to change content quite a bit. This is a slider that will slide across. I don't know why it's not doing it right now. Come on.
That's okay. My picture's up there, so it's probably better.
It might be that. That's true. It will slide across with all the new content of what we've been putting up lately, including podcasts or book reviews or topical things that kind of match the time. And so it's a great place to visit, I would say, at least weekly. There's Greg. Note that we also have these 50th anniversary ads. I think Boyd will talk about that a little bit, but we're really excited about the 50th anniversary, and thus are putting a lot of space to the 50th anniversary on our website, Prime Real Estate, as they call it. And our, you click on to any of these places, and you'll get into the 50th anniversary. Oh, let's click here. And where we're selling tickets for the gala, which we don't have very many left, so really if you haven't gotten your tickets, get them quickly. As well as we'll have places to, we're going to have in the next couple of months as we get closer and closer to the gala, a lot of just cool little tidbits about dialogue, people who've spoken about dialogue, who love dialogue, and just some neat things. So really pay attention to that, and hopefully you can all come to the gala. And if not, we're also having a conference that same day that will be free with amazing speakers who love and promote dialogue in amazing ways. Another feature of the website is the podcast. That's where you'll find the Miller Echoes Miller Echoes presentations that Morris will put together. He does a great job. We're going to have a couple more different kinds of podcasts that are inserted in between those Miller Echoes events as well, and there are some already, but you'll see a few more as we get a little bit closer, including this. This will probably end up being a podcast, and so if you're a podcast listener, I think Dialogue's one of the best. I am biased, but I also listen to a lot of them, and I think I'm right. You also have the book reviews. Book reviews are neat on Dialogue's website because you not only have the book reviews that you can find within the pages of Dialogue, but our new book review editors are trying to do a lot of new content. And so they'll actually you'll find book reviews that you will not find in the journal itself. So some of the technological things that we're trying to do lately is we have an HTML set up now for the those who like to read their articles and issues online. We're also getting the EPUB. We have a little bit of problems with that, so we're trying to get that working. But for those who like to read a PDF on their devices, we have PDFs. For those who like a little bit more flexibility of the HTML, we have the HTML. Going on with that, we also have the Kindle editions for those who love Kindles. And for the 50th year, we decided to take down our price down to $4.99. And so they're a lot more, I think, affordable. And so if you love to read Dialogue on Kindle, It's easy. Just grab one. What else? Oh, another great feature of the website that we have is the newsletter. So if you want to stay, if you like to have email newsletters, we have a monthly newsletter. You just put in your subscription, your email into the subscription, and it will automatically start getting all of the newsletters. And the newsletters are pretty much a correlated content of all the stuff that we've done in the past month. Okay, so just to kind of talk a little bit about, Christine kind of mentioned the fact that Dialogue is a place that people don't know that they should go to when they're having discussions about issues in Mormonism. Dialogue is the foundation, and probably most of you know that, but a lot of people online are having the same conversations that have been had for years in the pages of Dialogue and other places. And so I really think that if they understood that you have to have the foundation of Dialogue before they had the discussions, we could further our conversation more quickly, and we could get to places that maybe could be a little bit more healthy. And so just to kind of give an example of that, if you have any issues about women in the church, you always should start with the pink issue. That's just where you should go. You should go to the pink issue, read through the pink issue, so that you have your foundation. And that's your starting point. And then, you know, we're continuing. Well, and then go to the Laurels. I love Laurel. Anything that Laurel writes inside Dialogue, you should pull up. This is the pink issue Dialogue and beyond. So then they've furthered the conversation. So then you should go to some of the more recent issues where we have Corey Crawford talking about female authority. And then you have Fiona Givens. Both of them appeal to different kinds of, Corey Crawford adds to the conversation by appealing to the biblical authority, and Fiona, in this very last issue, appeals to the restoration authority in talking about how we should be talking about women, priesthood, authority, all of those kinds of things. And it's timely, it's important, and it gives you, again, a foundation to be able to have these conversations with people online, people in your wards, people in your family, whatever you want to do. They're just brilliant. One of my things that I like to advertise for people who don't know Dialogue is the From the Pulpits. That's something that's been going on for years and years and years. I think from the beginning, first issue, was that a Gene England thing to do? Do we know? Who started the From the Pulpits? Do we know?
I think it was early.
I think it was probably a Gene England thing. And they've continued throughout the ensuing decades. And so if you're at church and you do not hear something uplifting, go home and read it from the pulpit. These are people that have given amazing talks from all over the world in times, mostly United States, but we have also reached internationally from some of these, and they stir your soul. So if you're not soul stirred at church, go home and get soul stirred in the pages of Dialogue. They're amazing. I love them. Going on to something like LGBT issues. Oh, here's a From the Pulpit from a recent one. Paul Reeves, it's gorgeous. Oh my gosh, I could read it over and over again. If you're interested in LGBT issues, you start in the pages of Dialogue, and you get very quickly to Taylor Petrie's article, which is amazing. I wrote about it here, and I like the way I wrote of it. It brilliantly imagines how Mormonism, at its most expansive, can make the theological room needed to be beautifully inclusive. That's what he does. And it both shows how Mormonism can be amazing, and it shows how we can be more loving. It's this gorgeous reimagining of the way our theology works that is just incredible. I love it. It makes me so excited to be a Mormon every time I read his essay. And I think that anyone interested in LGBT issues should look at it. And again, foundation. This is a foundational thing. So you guys are a little lucky. You get to be one of the first people to see the summer issue that is coming out. We're going to release these, I think, a little bit early because it is so timely. And we have news. We have another news article that came out just about youth suicides and LGBT. So, you know, Boyd, understanding that this is timely, gets this really quickly into his tenure. And so just to kind of read, this is the LGBTQ Mormon Crisis Responding to this Empirical Research on Suicide by Michael Barker, Daniel Parkinson, and Benjamin Knoll. And they're going to be, in this article, they ask some of these questions and consider some of these questions. What direct empirical evidence is available regarding LGBTQ youth suicides? What is the indirect evidence? What is the anecdotal evidence? What conclusions can we draw, taking into account the limitations of empirical, inferred, and anecdotal evidence? What preventative measures should be implemented while we are waiting for the more definitive empirical evidence? And then we go on, and there's an additional article that Benjamin Knoll has done called Youth Suicide Rates and the Mormon Religious Context. So he even pulls more of this in with just amazing results. Again, this will be out in just a few days. It's very timely. You've got articles from just this year that they're using as a research base, and this is something that's really important. Within the same article, you're going to have a big section on the Mama Dragons, and I don't know, do we call this article LGBT-themed? Probably heavily influenced, but something that's needed. We need to have this information out now, and so Dialogue is not only, you know, putting together foundational texts for people to have discussions, it also can be a place that people find the information that they need to be having conversations with their children, their family members, whatnot. I think I kind of went too fast, but if you guys have any questions about the website, I can answer pretty much anything of how to find things, where to go, suggestions, all of those things we can kind of talk it about. But overall, you're going to find amazing things in Dialogue, both online that I'm showing you and in the pages. If you're not subscribing, I wonder why not, because this year is our 50th anniversary and we're doing a 50% off subscription rate, which I think most people don't know about because we still get people full subscribing, and I'm like, okay, we'll take it. But you can also subscribe for 50% off this year because it's the honor of our Jubilee. And if any of you are interested, we have issues at the table. If you haven't been a subscriber for a little while and you want to see where Boyd's direction is going to go in the next couple of years, a good way to do that is to pick up the most recent journal and come just kind of look and see, and then remind yourself that dialogue is amazing. So anyway, that's it.
And how much do the archive articles cost?
Oh, so the archive articles, I didn't talk about that. The archive articles are all free. So you go to the archive, and the open archive is all the way up to 2014. And then, and we have a lot of scholars and student scholars who come here to enhance their research by going to the pages of our archives here. And then it's just the past 2 years that are considered the premium issues. And so there's a lot to be found, even if you don't want to subscribe. So, the end.
Well, it is a mass of wires back here. I can't tell you. It's really kind of crazy. there we go. That's better. Yeah. So I want to highlight that last word that she said, free. That's kind of cool. I love that word, especially when it comes to, you know, articles. You don't that's like... teachers, people who are employed at universities get articles for free, but most, you know, people out there have to pay. And if you've ever tried to buy something that's an academic article online, typically they run like $50. So I get really excited about that. But anyway, so on one of my first dates with my then fiance Zina, she took me to a fireside sponsored by the BYU Honors Program that featured English professor Eugene England. Now, my wife had taken an honors colloquium from Gene and raved about what an awe-inspiring teacher he was. But my initial impression of Gene was shock rather than awe. He began the lecture that night by talking about Mountain Meadows Massacre, the William Martin Handcart Company, and the disaster of that trek, the biblical narrative of Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. I was starting to get pretty nervous, and Gene did not flinch from the troubling details. He told of the Mormons following obediently their ecclesiastical leaders and brutally killing men, women, and children of the Francher Party. He discussed Levi Savage's passionate plea that the Willie Company wait until the following spring to cross the plains, and how he was scolded by church leaders for not having enough faith. He saw all of these as Abrahamic tests of integrity and faith. And I remember growing more and more uncomfortable as Gene continued. I was fresh from a Mormon mission and full of zeal, and I started to wonder exactly what kind of fireside I was attending. I thought maybe she'd taken me to ex-Mormons for Jesus or something. But then Gene switched gears, not abruptly and not without forcing us to confront the horrors of these stories, but he began to help us work toward a solution, a place where we could appreciate the paradoxical demands of personal integrity and obedience. I remember Gene reciting Joseph Smith's aphorism that by proving contraries, truth is made manifest, and assuring us that Mormonism requires us to unify heart and mind in order to find truth. That fireside was a major turning point in my life. Gene ended up being our bishop after we got married. And he came to help me to understand that faith and intellect are not two separate realms, parts of the brain that you have to keep shielded from one another. But the integration of the two was the only way for them to be fully expanded. Intelligence broadens faith, and faith broadens intelligence. Soon I discovered Gene's book, Dialogues with Myself, and then I discovered his brainchild, Dialogue, A Journal of Mormon Thought, which began in 1966, and I began exploring all these past issues of Dialogue. And in those days, you had to go to the library and photocopy, and I repeat, pay for those articles. But I did. I mean, I was a poor undergraduate, newly married, and I just was absorbing these like crazy. In 1966, when Gene and Wes Johnson and a group of young scholars at Stanford University envisioned this independent Mormon journal, they were thinking of something that spoke to both faith and intellect, bringing together academic rigor, artistic quality, diverse perspectives, and heartfelt conviction. In the journal's inaugural issue, Gene argued that Mormonism is, by definition, a dialogic religion, that speaking from our hearts and listening compassionately to others is central to the Mormon project. And he saw the journal as a vehicle for understanding and healing. Constructive and charitable dialogue, Gene argued, will not solve all of our intellectual and spiritual problems, he said, and it will not save us, but it can bring us joy and new vision and help us toward that dialogue with our deepest selves and with our God, which can save us. Now, Dialogue became one of the main venues where Latter-day Saints discussed national and international issues of the day. They dealt with the Vietnam War, the Equal Rights Amendment, civil rights movement, as well as with unique Mormon issues like blacks and the priesthood and the discovery of the Joseph Smith papyri. And Dialogue has, I believe, been a positive force in Mormonism, modeling both ways to navigate faith and the channels between reason and faith, and providing a better appreciation of Mormonism's bold and expansive worldview. Since its inception, Dialogue has been a reflection of Gene England's vision of bringing together faith and reason in a conversation, inviting both integration and expansion of the reader's soul. Dialogue's mission has been established, and it currently is, to encourage, quote, a variety of viewpoints, demand accurate scholarship, and exercise responsible judgment while bringing LDS faith into dialogue with the larger stream of world religious thought and with human experience as a whole, and to foster artistic and scholarly achievement based on the LDS cultural heritage. Now, ever since those days of my undergraduate education, Dialogue has been an important part of my intellectual life and faith journey. I remember being challenged by essays about Brigham Young's Adam God teachings, for example. And I'm putting up the cover art for some of these articles because it's so fun. Blacks and the Priesthood. This was a seminal essay by Lester Bush. The Progression of God, Post-Manifesto Polygamy by D. Michael Quinn. The Evolution of the Temple Ceremony. These were challenging issues. But I also remember my faith being given new grounding, usually by the same essays that challenged me, providing new ways to think about these controversial issues and my faith. Duane Jeffrey's essay on evolution challenged me to accept the major premises of science over those of contemporary church leaders like Elder McConkie and President Joseph Fielding Smith. But in that same essay, he cautioned that Mormon thought was compatible with secular science. Bert Wilson's essay on the three Nephites in modern Mormonism caused me to doubt many of the fantastic stories that I had heard in Sunday school and on my mission, giving me what I now see as a healthy skepticism. But it also helped me to see how these stories create community and how valuable the very notion of community is. And Eugene England's essay on fidelity, polygamy, and celestial marriage helped me to accept that God may have had a hand in the beginnings of polygamy, but that I don't have to accept it as an eternal principle. Even more important, Dialogue has confronted hot issues head-on without flinching, but bringing together all sides of the conversation in a civil, well-reasoned discussion, issues like warfare, the discovery of the Joseph Smith papyri, the Book of Abraham, and more recently gay marriage have proved that discussion can foster better understanding and, most importantly, model responsible civil dialogue. I believe this is sorely needed in our society. My perception is that even as we Mormons get better at talking with non-Mormons, we're pretty bad at talking with our fellow Mormons. Epithets like apostate and apologist are still too commonly thrown at those we disagree with. I believe this damage can best be repaired by more discussion and more empathy. This is one of the most important roles I think dialogue fills within the Mormon community. Now, before beginning my tenure and this is the essay that Emily just pointed out about post-heterosexual Mormon theology. Before beginning my tenure as the editor, I read Devery Anderson's four-part history of dialogue, and we're hoping to have that continued next year, and reviewed its five decades of content. And I'm surprised at how little has changed and how relevant much of that content remains. I've also realized how revolutionary the internet has been. When dialogue moved from California to Virginia, and then from Virginia to Utah, it required a moving truck. The journal needed extensive office space to house the staff required to publish and distribute the journal. And when I took over, no moving vans were necessary. We just changed email passwords and got onto Dropbox. So zero moving vans. It was really pretty simple, and it's allowed me to work with production and editorial staff around the world. My production editor is in Alabama. I have editorial staff who live as far away as Japan and New Zealand. So it's really quite an amazing thing that the internet has allowed us to do. It's a much smoother, in many ways, operation than it used to be. But the internet's also had a huge effect on Mormonism in the last few years. While it's facilitated support for the various subgroups of our community, it's also balkanized the conversation, creating little echo chambers for like-minded individuals. Furthermore, information's free access has sometimes led to a disenchantment with and disengagement from the church. Dialogue is, I believe, even more important today than it was in 1966. Now, presently, many Latter-day Saints are struggling with women's status in the church, with policies about LGBTQ members, and with discovering the dusty and often disconcerting corners of church history that they were unaware existed. Dialogue is, I believe, a venue where we can explore these issues. But here we are able to do this with greater depth and nuance than the internet or blog posts allow. I've been surprised how many times I'll write like a 3-page essay, post it on my blog, and have people tell me it's too long. And yet, you know, Dialogue's able to publish these long-form essays that really can get into this material and give us, I believe, a much more interesting, a fuller developed, and much more nuanced background on these issues. Dialogue's also become the flagship journal of the burgeoning Mormon studies discipline. Now, as Christine mentioned, there's more and more places where Mormon studies articles are published, but I think academics still turn to Dialogue as one of the first stops on their journey for information about Mormonism. Now, as the new editor, I'm committed to continuing the legacy that's been established by my predecessors. Specifically, I envision Dialogue providing research and commentary about both contemporary and historical Mormonism that are timely, relevant, respectful, and reliable. I welcome all voices and want to encourage all voices to the conversation. I want the journal to model productive discussion that challenges our minds and hearts. And I want to continue expanding that discussion beyond the Intermountain West to encompass global Mormonism in all its varieties, to engage with other religious traditions, as well as with secular society. I take my editorial cues from a letter Joseph Smith wrote from Liberty Jail. The things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. thy mind, O man, and I think we should add, O woman, if thou wilt lead a soul into salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and search into and contemplate the lowest consideration of the darkest abyss and expand upon the broad considerations of eternal expanse. He and she must commune with God. Dialogue is and will continue to be a permanent record of Mormonism's beauty, variety, complexity, and depth. Thank you.
I just had a couple of things. One is, did I hear you correctly that if you're on the BYU faculty, you cannot publish with Dialogue or should not or something?
If you don't have tenure, right?
What's that?
You don't have tenure. If you have tenure.
So
that helps.
Let me start by saying we're working on that.
Yeah.
BYU has been very resistant to this. Back in the 90s, as you know, there was this huge uproar about, alternate voices, and Dialogue kind of got lumped in there as an alternate voice. Now, I think we should be proud to be an alternate voice. We don't want to be just another voice. We want to be another voice, an other voice, right? Something that's different, unique, and important. But yes, it did cause controversy, and so for a long time there, BYU has had this kind of policy. And so anybody who is applying to BYU, if they've had Dialogue publications, that has been a mark against them, and typically it's ruled them out. And if somebody's going up for tenure or for promotion, that's often been a consideration. Or if the mere consideration or affiliation in some way, being on an editorial board or something like that, has gone against them. So, yes, that has been a situation. Now, there have been a lot of very brave people who have defied that.
Yeah.
My recent issue, we had at least one BYU professor, my wife, who published in Dialogue. And in the next issue, we will have a BYU professor who's publishing in Dialogue. So we're working on this.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it sound like we're going to just backtrack and become, a lapdog for BYU. But I think in order to have real dialogue, you need those voices. And the original Dialogue had them. And so I really want to try to bring those voices back.
I mean, been 48 years ago now. I was a young kid just about finishing high school. My brother was in college in Boston. And he learned that I was struggling with a bunch of things. And, reading McConkie Doctrine and whatever else and finding it distressing. And so he bought me a subscription to Dialogue, and I've been in trouble ever since. But I just got through reading the biography of Leonard Arrington, and one of the things he said that I absolutely endorse and agree with completely, which is that there are all kinds of people. This conference is illustrative too. There are all kinds of people who, without Dialogue, without Sunstone, we wouldn't be in the church anymore.
Yeah.
And we're here because we really became convinced that people can be thoughtful and engaging and struggling and still hold on to a real faith. And that's well worth keeping around.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's a lot of people, myself included, whose testimony or commitment to the church is because of Dialogue, not in spite of it. I think it. If I had just encountered some of these issues without all the nuance and depth that Dialogue provides, I would be, flipping out. But furthermore, I think Dialogue set an example of people. I found this community of people who was trying to make Mormonism work for him, and that That has really helped me too. So I agree. I think dialogue is an essential part of that. I think it's, and again, I think it goes beyond the blogger knackle. Blogs are great. I love blogs. I think dialogue, participates in those and promotes blogs. But the long form prose that we get in dialogue and the depth that we're able to get is really important. I know it.
I have a testimony.
One of the best decisions they made when they started dialogue was to give the brethren three issues.
Did that continue? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do all the general still have three issues?
They've always been offered, so from my understanding, whether or not they take it up on their offer.
Thank you for working on the BYU thing. I go to Claremont Graduate University, and I am done with coursework because I don't live there anymore. But I, like most of my colleagues and classmates and friends, would like to publish in dialogue, but don't.
Yeah.
We could call it fear, but I think it's also a responsibility where they, because of the job market being so tight, they have to keep this option open.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I published with Joanna Brooks and Hannah the book on Mormon feminism that I figured I lost my chance anyway, so I might as well publish in dialogue. So I have one article that I have. So aside from the fact that like a lot of the natural people that are my age that would be publishing, how do you try to find younger folks to publish when like the normal people who would be these writers can't be, like, in the current situation, yeah. I guess? Like, what do you guys try to do to get other people of younger voices?
That is a really, I think, important question. I mean, I realize when I'm asking a young person like you to publish in dialogue, it is a career issue, because...
It's not for me anymore.
Not anymore, yeah. Please keep submitting. So that's why I think that's another reason why I think it's really important to work that relationship, because we want those young scholars involved,
and they want to be involved.
Yeah, so I've got 5 years to work this problem. I'm going to do my best.
Thank you.
Boyd, I'm interested in the nuts and bolts of dialogue, and I don't know if you have had a chance to really familiarize yourself with some of those things. But so I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about where subscriptions stand, how that compares over time, also the funding of dialogue, how does income break down, and what are subscriptions like? Income from subscriptions, then income from donations, just that kind of thing, and then what you see for the future.
That's a really good question. So in terms of subscriptions, I read the Devery Anderson piece, and if I'm remembering correctly, when that article, he only did the four parts, and it ends in, I'm not sure what year, but it goes up through, it doesn't get to the Chandlers. The Petersons, yeah. It ends with the Petersons. And at that time, I believe the subscription was around 4,000, if I'm not mistaken, that subscribed. After the Alternate Voices talk, evidently that had a huge impact on subscriptions. And I think our subscription rate now is probably around 1,000. So it's quite a bit less. Now, that's also, I hope we can keep growing that. But I think, one of the problems in this era is that people are used to getting things online and for free. And that's a problem I think any publication has to deal with anymore, either online for free or online for very cheap. So I think dialogue has to start, as many things do, I think, have to start thinking in terms of alternate funding methods. So we're working on that. We're discussing that right now. Increased donations. So part of what we're doing with the gala is trying to encourage donations. But also, I think, you know, for example, a lot of organizations now have options where you can, you know, you become a friend of whatever, right? And Mormons are used to that. You know, you have the Friend of Scouting Drive every year. So a Friend of Dialogue Drive is not that probably hard to for people to fathom. So we're thinking of alternative funding methods. We do have a fairly decent foundation, though, of a financial base. It's not rock solid, as any Mormon publication isn't, but we're doing pretty well. We've had some very good people managing the money. So we'll be around at least for my 5 years. That's good. What was the rest of your question, nuts and bolts? Yeah, well, I think we're here for the long haul. I mean, I really do. I think we're in good shape. We've got a very energetic board right now. Patrick Mason was the head of the board, and now it's Joanna Brooks. She's going to be taking over. Yeah. I mean, I think, and in fact, it's kind of interesting. Studies are showing now that trends are showing anyway that paper is kind of coming back. People are starting to get back to paper again. So I don't see that as changing. I think we'll continue to do the paper version. I don't know that we'll ever get much, you know, I don't know if we'll ever end up in the 3,000 range in the near future, because, again, a lot of people would prefer their content on their Kindle or to read it online. But I think we're in good shape, and we will continue to publish in paper for the foreseeable future.
So, yeah. And we have pretty high website rates. A lot of people do love the website.
So we have good website rate, and the content is continually updated. We keep that going. Yes, you can get subscription for paper or electronic subscription only. And again, all our older stuff is free. All the newer stuff, there is you can subscribe to it, but you can also just download a particular article. So this Fiona Givens article that we did, it caught a lot of attention, and I'm not sure how
did we figure out
how many.
We've had a lot.
It was overwhelming how many downloads we had, and that was like $3 an article. You know, people are fine spending $3 to download an article, and it got a lot of heavy traffic. So, so that kind of thing could be part of the future as well, I think.
We're trying to figure that out, actually, as we start to kind of brainstorm ways that we can reach the demographics we're not reaching. And I don't know. I always consider the Mormon journals and everything, there's this break. We have quite a few of the older, and then we have quite a few of the younger who are becoming interested in stuff, but we're missing the lost generation that happened when the alternate voices came about.
Yeah.
And we lost the historical generation, and we lost the dialogue generation. So that's the one that's probably the lowest. Then next is probably, you know, the very, very young, the just becoming adults thing. That's from my understanding. We're doing studies. We have some analytics that we're working on.
Well, what you just said answers part of my question. You know, there's an older and there's a younger, and there's kind of this lost generation in between. I wonder how much of these Mormon studies programs that are starting to really appear again, not again, but starting to spread, might influence people to not only be interested in this, but contribute and grow it. If you've seen anything coming from that, because just today, my daughter told me that now she's going to pursue a PhD in this, and which basically is the area that will lead to more of this type of thing, mostly because of the inspiration of the physical writings left from her grandfather. So do you see that type of thing happening, a younger generation coming because of these formal study programs that really kind of link into this purpose?
I think so. There's a lot of collaborative Yes, in this generation that's coming up, they love to share their information. I think a lot of times older scholars would be much more, you know, this is my information, and this new generation understands the need to share their findings, to share it about as much as possible, and so you see that among the journals that are even here. Christine mentioned the biggest competitor being the Mormon Studies Review, but there's a lot of collaboration between those that work on that and the people who are on the boards of dialogue and the people that are submitting, and I think that is just a wonderful thing to continue to foster, and as long as we understand that, you know, this information is here to be shared, to be discussed, to be understood by as many people as we possibly can. And so then we get into the ideas of, you know, we have something new coming out. We have this LGBT youth suicide stuff that's going to have a lot of, you know, a lot of impact. And so how do we share that? How do we get the most people interested in that? Do we keep it behind a paywall? So those are all conversations that we're having constantly. And it all kind of builds together, I think, in trying to reach people while staying financially solvable. Yeah. So.
I think, too, Christine really pointed out a problem for us, and that is that with the institutionalization of Mormon studies, a lot of people are looking for journals that are not dialogue. I mean, if you can publish in church history, for example, that's going to get you much further on your vita than if you publish in Dialogue. Dialogue is a peer-reviewed journal, and I think we exact some pretty good standards, but she's right that because we're multidisciplinary and that we do publish stuff that deals with faith as well as with, you know, the more religious studies, Mormon studies kind of content, there are boards that look down on it. Now, I've talked to scholars who've had no problem counting dialogue articles on their vita, and it's looked great. I've talked to others who've said, no, I don't put it on there, and BYU people just don't go there. So I think, you know, we do have a challenge in this new era where we're trying to do something that's kind of unique because we are an academic journal. We want to be thought of as an academic journal, but we also don't want to ignore the inside community of faith. And so that's a real challenge to us. And I think that's a challenge built into the journal by your father. Yeah. He left us with this legacy where we have to kind of live in both worlds.
Yeah.
And that's a place I'm comfortable living in.
Well, don't expect to be comfortable living in.
Yeah, well, okay.
Committed to living.
I'm committed, yeah.
Another thing that I'm seeing from the online perspective is that there are a lot of younger generations who completely bypass dialogue. So you've got the people who are faithful to their core, and then they're suddenly out. And so that's another thing that we're struggling with in terms of just reaching a generation to say, you know, there is a middle ground. There's a moderate place that you can kind of stop and stay for a while that can kind of either facilitate maybe a cleaner, nicer way of leaving, that you don't have to have the ex-Mormon narratives of bitterness. So dialogue can actually serve a purpose of smoothing, I think, as well as keeping, because it's such a good example of people staying engaged in Mormonism while dealing with a whole bunch of different things. And so, again, a generation that, you know, is constantly online, constantly needing to be have their information at their fingertips and have the information quickly can do jumps that are unfortunate, that I think that we are trying to also, you know, we're here to help, we're here to show a moderate middle ground between your faith and your intellect, and that can merge it in beautiful ways. Where it's not exactly correct, but it's a pretty good
overgeneralization.
Yeah, it's an overgeneralization that a lot of that generation are like, no, we really will do this, but you have to give us good stuff. Our time is important to us, and so we will put in the time to put things together. But a lot of it is they don't know that it's there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I love the term that your dad used again, the radical middle, right? The sense that it is a middle, but it's a radical middle. This is a place that it requires some effort. It's not an easy middle. It's a radical middle.
So I had a question very similar to yours. Thank you. Maybe I can just build on that a little bit. I'm really interested in kind of navigating the Mormon studies landscape as it's starting to emerge. I just got a job here at the U and have this really interesting opportunity that I never thought I would have to be engaged in some Mormon studies initiatives with the stuff that's happening at the Tanner Center. And so, yeah, like I did a PhD that's not very, it's in rhetoric, but not necessarily related to Mormon studies, but now there's this potential. And I'm, you know, I think I kind of have things figured out a little bit in terms of what's happening at UVU and what's happening at BYU. It seems really odd to me, for example, that the Mormon Studies Review that's happening at BYU would potentially be an acceptable tenure-worthy publication, but not Dialogue. Maybe you could differentiate a bit between those two. But then if you wouldn't mind just saying something about just that Mormon studies landscape in general. Thanks.
Well, it's interesting because BYU publishes two very good, I think, peer-reviewed journals that deal with Mormon studies, both the Maxwell Institute's Mormon Studies Review and BYU Studies Quarterly, I think they're called now. Both, I think, do great stuff. Neither of them would count for tenure at BYU. Yeah. You are discouraged from publishing in those I mean, it won't hurt you, but it's not going to count. So if you're a young scholar who's trying to get tenure at BYU, that's not going to do it. I would guess that that's similar to a lot of places. I think I don't know at the U of U what people would say if you published in the Maxwell Institute's journal or BYU Studies. I'm guessing, though, that a lot of schools, they'd say, well, that's affiliated with Mormonism, so that's not going to count. That's, again, those are interesting things because, I think BYU undervalues its own forte, you know, and this has been a problem I've had with BYU for a long time. It's like, we wouldn't expect Brandeis not to do Jewish studies, or Catholic University has the, you know, this is the pontifically funded Catholic school, and they do Catholic studies, and yet BYU is really reticent to do Mormon studies. And in fact, I've talked to several people at BYU who are in high positions, and you use the word Mormon studies there, and they will say it's a dirty word, which I'm astonished by. I can't quite fathom how Mormon studies is a dirty word. So BYU is a special place. I think, you know, again, the in terms of the Mormon studies landscape, a lot of really exciting things are happening. The U's doing, Bob Goldberg's doing some really terrific things here. My colleague Brian Birch is now the fellow for this, Marlon Jensen fellow for next year. And so they're doing exciting stuff. Claremont, University of Virginia. I think we at UVU actually have more Mormon studies courses than any other campus. We have four that are regularly taught at least yearly, some twice a year, in four different departments, Mormon studies courses. And so in terms of Mormon studies, there's just a lot going on. Now, that being said, would I recommend somebody doing a PhD in Mormon studies? No. I think that would be. I didn't do mine in Mormon studies, and my career has been a real roller coaster. So, just being a Mormon studies person can be a real problem in the academy still. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's an interesting, exciting, and sometimes treacherous moment in academia.
Maybe just one quick follow-up. I think that especially here at the U, the student body and the undergrad in particular are really loved, very interested.
Yeah.
Some of them are in, some of them are out, some of them are, there's
same at UVU.
Yeah. And so they're
Oh, yeah.
Lived here kind of in the culture. So, yeah.
Yeah. What is your, what are the professors feeling at this point? Because I know at times, I know Bob came out and was really adamant that...
He's been here a year. Bob gave me and a colleague some money to teach a performance class this summer. So that's, and I have 10 students.
Oh, wow.
That when we did great dialogue, you know.
Good.
We read the Petri article and blew their minds.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's exciting. I mean, I did my PhD here at the U, and I never really felt any sense that Mormon studies would be, or being Mormon even, was looked down upon. But I had people that I talked to who felt like they, you know, had comments made by professors that they kind of looked down on Mormonism or whatever, and so.
I know people were at other institutions who applied here.
Well, I think Gene England had an issue with that, right? He was too Mormon for Utah and too sketchy for BYU. And yeah.
Another problem that Mormon journals kind of face, and we're seeing this replicated again now that we're in the political season, is that we are somebody that explains Mormon study, you know, anything. Any of the Mormon studies groups are trying to explain Mormons to the outside world. And so Dialogue has long felt, has long been a part of that. And this Mormon Studies Review and all these other places that they've started these Mormon studies programs, that's what, you know, that's the go-to for the national, you know. But we still have people like Gary Johnson just yesterday saying very wrong things about Mormonism and his views about Mormonism on a national stage. And now today is now coming back to clarify, well, this is actually what I meant, because I'm sorry I didn't understand Mormonism in this way. And so he had to be educated to, you know. And so these people, these, you know, these different schools trying to set up these Mormon, you know, we just have a lot of educating that has to be done on the outside world as well as trying to speak the Mormonese that we need to speak to all the people that we possibly can within Mormonism. It's a great challenge.
Yeah.
Well, we'd like to thank you guys for this panel.
Thank you.